This is the news podcast from Israel Next, the podcast for an inspired and credible Israel engagement. And I'm Ruach Sorensen. This is Inside Out, giving you the Israeli perspectives on the news. And today is February 17th. So, another week and another Inside Out. And these are the topics we will discuss today. The preparation for the law reform are continuing, those that oppose this reform, they are using increasingly dubious methods. So we will talk about some of the things that have happened this last past week. The terrorism in Jerusalem also causes the National Security Minister to overreact, I would say. And that happens as the government as a whole, they provided the traditional answer to terrorism, which is the traditional Zionist answer, which is building in the Jewish communities in Judea and Samaria, so-called settlements. And that, of course, causes reactions internationally. But at the same time that they come with the declaration to build more, the defense minister also orders the military to destroy a Jewish-owned olive grove just outside of Shiloh, this biblical place in Samaria. So that leads to internal divisions in the government coalition. And this week's Torah portion is called Mishpatim, and it lists a number of laws. So, the question I'm asking here first, because we dealt quite a lot with details of the judicial reform last week. So now I'm not going to go into that. I'm going to talk about the things that happen around this. What is democracy and what is democratic behavior? That's really the question. Because this last week has seen some troubling incidents taking place. The opposition says that this law reform means the end of democracy. And they are really speaking in apocalyptic terms about what will happen if this reform passes. And to oppose it, they are using a lot of protests. They're using huge, massive protests, like with the tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of protesters. And also other means, of course, also in the Knesset. But I would say that this week they have crossed some really serious borders. Borderlines that they shouldn't cross. What has been done until now is they have been blocking roads with these huge crowds of people, and blocking roads is okay. That's within the limit if you willingly move when the police comes to remove you. So you could see that as legitimate. Then they have also, or this just this week, yesterday. That was in preparation for the coming demonstration that is going to take place on Saturday evening, tomorrow evening after the Shabbat ends. Some activists, they stole a tank, a military tank. It's a museum thing because it's from the war of 1973, the Yom Kippur War, but it's being used as a memorial site. So this tank was a Syrian tank standing there, was destroyed during the war. And I'm not sure if it was a Syrian or an Israeli tank, but anyway, it has been destroyed since the Yom Kippur War in 1973. And standing there as a memorial site, also commemorating the deaths of a number of soldiers, more than 30 soldiers, that their names were inscribed there on a memorial and still are. But this was a memorial, and so they decided, veterans of this war, that is to say, they had themselves fought in the war, they decided we were going to take this tank and bring it to the demonstration for whatever reason, that they wanted also to cover it in like a huge copy of the Declaration of Independence that they themselves then signed. So to say that we are standing for this Declaration of Independence, and what that tank would symbolize, one can only imagine. But you know, many regimes around the world have been overthrown by military power, and that I'm not going to say what these activists hinted at, but that wouldn't be too far-fetched. Because also, in addition to this, you have Yesh Atid's members of Knesset. Yesh Atid is this centrist party from where Yair Lapid comes, who was the previous prime minister, and he is now the opposition leader. So in the law committee that is discussing, or at least trying to discuss, the judicial reform, you have these members of his party. Yair Lapid himself is not there, but members of his party are there. And they are misbehaving to the worst extent you can almost imagine. And it hit a new low this week when some of them jumped over this huge round table. I mean, it's circular. It's a circle of tables. They're standing in the circle, but it's open in the middle. So they jumped across and into this middle circle, standing in the midst of the tables there, and screaming and threatening the committee leader, Simcha Rotman, or threatening, I wouldn't, not using violence, but really screaming him in his face. And several of them, and when the Sadranim, which is called the ushers, the people that are there to keep quiet and calm, security, when they came to take them out, they did not cooperate. They fought them. This is a first. This hasn't happened in the Knesset before. And it was really a low. And at other times, there's MKs, they were sitting there and banging on the table and singing loud childish song, whatever it was, just to disrupt the entire debate in this committee. So, I mean, this is, there's this expression about the Polish parliament, but I mean, now this is, can almost use the expression now, Israeli parliament. This is going far beyond what is acceptable. Then we have the former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, who is also very opposed to this reform. And he started speaking about taking weapons in hands. He said like this, this is going to be war. And in a war, you fight head to head, face to face. So speaking in these terms, and also Ron Huldai, who is the mayor, current mayor of Tel Aviv, he also said that dictatorships are not overthrown without bloodshed. So really speaking in extreme terms here, and it's just so sad to hear these things, and also thinking about these are leaders, what signals are they sending to other people? So in addition to this, then we have the opposition leader also speaking in the Knesset, and he is just very uncompromising. And he says that, well, we will not even talk to the coalition unless they accept stopping this legislation for 60 days. I mean, 60 days, that's quite a long time. The president will, during that time, organize a committee from left and right, and academics and organizations and everybody that want to have a say on this reform. And then when everything has been said and done in this committee, then the president will make the recommendations. This is what should be done, and we will all agree to his recommendations. So that's his plan. And first of all, that president, of course, is from the Labour Party. Of course, now he's not connected to a party. He is the president, and he's above politics in that sense. He should be a uniting figure. But everybody knows that this is a very young man that became president very early in his life, and he is most likely going back to politics. And so it's very hard to disconnect him from his political views. So anyway, that this is of course not acceptable for the coalition, and they just reject that out of hand, because why do you want to establish a forum outside of the Knesset, the parliament? That's where you're supposed to discuss these things. This committee that they are disrupting, that's the one that is supposed to discuss this. That's where all the preparations take place before, when a normal law is prepared. And then you bring in experts into that panel, to that committee. So it's really putting everything upside down, and it seems like a method to try just to delay the whole reform. That's what Yair Lapid was aiming for. But anyway, he refuses to talk. And so there have been going on some talks where Lapid has been to the president himself. And then later on, Simcha Rotman, who heads this law committee, has been there. But it doesn't seem to happen a lot, at least not a lot is coming out. But really pray and hope that things are happening behind the scenes. It's just also strange that Yair Lapid is so strict on laying down the rules here, because he lost the elections. And the losing side cannot dictate the rules for how this is going to play out, especially not when there are already rules. Then you can also discuss how wise it is by the coalition to push this reform through as it is and with all these steps at the same time. And I don't think that is wise. I think they should be very open for talks and so on, and even give a certain period for talks. But that's another thing. Right now, there is a forum, there is a forum for debating this, and it is the Knesset. So respect the Knesset, that's what I would, the parliament, that's what I would say to the opposition leader right now. Meanwhile, the terrorism in Jerusalem continued. As I was making my podcast last week, a terror attack took place, or just after, three persons were killed by a terrorist who drove into a crowd of people standing on a bus stop. And there were two children, brothers, 6 and 8 years old, on their way to celebrate Shabbat. And then a young man, 22, 23 years old, that was just married half a year ago. So tragic instance there. It happened, terror attack by a Jerusalem Arab. And then after that, there has also been stabbing attacks and other things. So another soldier lost his life when he was attacked on a bus by a 14-year-old. A 14-year-old with a knife. And this was at Shuafat refugee camp, the check post out of this refugee camp in Jerusalem, where he was attacked. And he wasn't really killed by the attacker. He was killed by the security guard that followed him on the bus. This was inside the bus. This security guard shot and mistakenly hit the other security guard from the border police. So anyway, another soldier who lost his life this week. Now, in response to all of these attacks, and most of them then emanating from Jerusalem, Ben-Gvir, the Minister of National Security, called immediately for a blockade of the Arab cities, the Arab neighborhoods in Jerusalem. It's unclear if he called for a blockade of all Arab neighborhoods or just the one that this terrorist on last Friday came from, Isawiya. But anyway, he called for this. The police then chief said, we cannot do that. That's against the law. It's collective punishment and so on. And he also asked, why do you want to do this? And the reason he said, Itamar Ben-Gvir said, the reason he wanted to do this was deterrence. But of course, that is an overreaction. And you cannot just do that. If a terrorist comes out of a certain village, you cannot punish the entire village. That's not the way it's done. Or even if there is a lot of support in that village for this terror attack, that's still not the way to do things. It's immoral. And the police then refused. They said it will damage even more. They will cause even more terror. So what they have done is they have put up more checkposts and they sent more police to these areas. Something that among the Arabs are seen as controversial or controversial as not acceptable. And they are there's fear of more rioting because of that. But in this, I have no problem. Let there be more police, more checkposts, but you cannot close people inside in their neighborhoods. Then, in addition to this reaction from Ben-Gvir, there has also been a law in the Knesset that went through this week, and it was a law to withdraw citizenship or permanent inhabitant. In East Jerusalem, the Arabs, most of them do not have citizenship. They have like permanent residence, permanent residency. So to withdraw these privileges from them, if they're from the terrorists, that is. Any terrorist performing an attack, he will have this withdrawn and he will be expelled also to Gaza or to Judea and Samaria. So that's a law that passed with a huge majority, with even opposition votes. So here's in the midst of all this controversy, we have at least an example of cooperation. That's good. Then when it comes to how to fight this terrorism in East Jerusalem, it's not easy because it's inside Israel. The way Israel sees this is Israel proper. They annexed East Jerusalem after the Six-Day War, and then later on in 1980, the Jerusalem law was made that says this is their capital undivided, East and West. But the status of the Arabs there, as I said, they have permanent residency, so it's a little different position there. Some of them have citizenship. But what is needed there is of course, you need to be tough against terrorists and the terror infrastructure. When you have clear evidence that persons are involved or are planning, you need to be there to gather the intelligence and so on. But what is needed is a comprehensive plan for the entire part of that city, because it has been neglected for all these years since Israel united Jerusalem. That part of the city has been neglected. It has not been given the right priorities when it comes to infrastructure such as sewage and water, and also building permits. The people, Arab population in that part of the town, they are some 380,000 people. It has increased tremendously, but the sewage and water has not been developed. So there's very bad conditions, and also other public services are not offered at the same level as in the western part of the city. So these are things that needs to be changed, and especially building permits, because they haven't regulated that part. Israel has been careful by taking complete control in the eastern part of the city, because every time they do something there, it leads to international condemnation. And the UN, they have this resolutions that they make, where they speak about Israel is changing the status and the character, and the culture and historical and the religious inheritance of this part of the city. So they condemn Israel for doing this, changing the character and culture and historical legacy. Now, it's very hard to see how Israel can change the historical legacy of a place where they themselves are responsible for the fact that this city exists at all. It's true, it was a Jebusite city from the very beginning, but the Jebusites are long gone, and the Jebusite legacy is nowhere to be found. So those that have the longest connection and those that really put this city on the map is the Jewish people. And so how they can change the legacy of it when they make it more Jewish, if that's what they do. And truly, that's not really what they are doing if they are building houses for Arabs. So, but anyway, that's an annual condemnation. And because of this international criticism, Israel has been careful in taking full control there. But that's what they need to do. They need to come up with regulation plans for how to build, where to build, so that the population can expand and develop in a normal way and not build illegally, which they have done. They have built so many houses that are built illegally. And when they don't get permits, you can almost understand them. But this leads, of course, to confrontation, and that they are always at the risk of having their house demolished, although that's very seldom that it happens. So anyway, in order to fight terrorism in the eastern part of Jerusalem, these things need to be done, and Israel also needs to take back control of the curriculum in the schools, because in many of the schools in East Jerusalem, it's the Palestinian Authority curriculum that is valid, that they use, and it's filled with anti-Semitism and encouragement to violence and terror. So there's no it's not a miracle that these children come out of these schools and they want to kill Jews. It's unfathomable that Israel hasn't taken control of this curriculum already and allowed this to happen. So what needs to be done is the same rights must be given to people in East Jerusalem, and there are both Jews and Arabs there. Same rights, but also same obligations. The law must be enforced at the same level as it is elsewhere. That's a true unification of Jerusalem, and that would be one part of fighting terror. It wouldn't eradicate terror, because there would always be there are other reasons. But then you need to fight it also in the schools, and also fight it in the social media, and bringing out truth, and also creating points, encounters between Jews and Arabs, because there are way too few encounters between them, especially in the young age. So I was listening to a podcast just this week. It didn't speak about East Jerusalem. It spoke about Arabs of the Palestinian Authority. And the young generation, the Set generation that is called, from born 2000 and later, they have they interviewed a bunch of those people, and they are the ones that are very influential in terrorism right now. And they said that they had never seen a Jew. They have never met a Jew. Many of them had never been into Israel. One had been to the Temple Mount once. And if they've seen some Jewish person, then it's a soldier. But they had never seen them. And the image they have of them is the one that they have been given in schools and in social media and TikTok, where the Jews are demonized by groups such as Hamas and ISIS and others. That's the image that they have, and that the only ideal for youth like them is to kill Jews. That's the way they grow up. So I remember I met, it was a few years ago, I met an Arab he lived in Bethlehem, or in a little town just outside of Bethlehem, and he was imprisoned. He got imprisoned during the first Intifada, that's like 1987, and sat there for like a decade or something in prison. But then he came out, and he has become a man who is really conciliatory. He's trying to reconcile Jews and Arabs. And he said just this, that the generation growing up now after Oslo separated between Jews and Arabs, because it created the Palestinian Authority and they became autonomous and so on, there's almost no contact between Jews and Arabs. After that, you have a generation who have no memories of working together with Jews, being together with Jews. So he said, you have to give them memories. That was what he said. Because he remembered before the Oslo that this is how it used to be. He went into Jerusalem, he saw Jews, that Jews came to Bethlehem and so on. They were shopping in each other's shops and so on. So you have to give them memories. And that's so important. A comprehensive unification of Jerusalem, that's what's needed. Then we come to this reaction, the other reaction from the government when it comes to terror. And this is a very Zionistic, whenever you have a right-wing government in Israel, this is their answer to terrorism, and it's to build houses in Judea and Samaria, in so-called West Bank. So what the government did now, that they approved 9 outposts, Jewish small settlements, but really illegal outposts, that they have been illegal also in the eyes of the Israeli government, because they didn't have the proper permits. Some of them were approved, or they had the backing of the government when they were established, like Ariel Sharon, he backed the establishment of some of these, but it never went through the entire system and got the proper legislation, so it was never approved properly, and therefore they are illegal until now, these 9, and there are many more like them, but these 9 were now approved. It's still not finished, it's in process there, but this was a very important step. There still need to be a planning a zone planning plan for this, like how to build and so on, where to build. So anyway, but this was the very important step. And it's an answer to terrorism. Another thing that the cabinet also said was that they will prepare now for building 10,000 houses in Judea and Samaria. And a final thing that the security cabinet decided was to reverse the 2005 decision that had dealt with the hitnatkut, the disengagement. But when we talk about the disengagement, we usually talk about Gaza, and that's of course the big part of this. But during that or in that agreement or disengagement agreement, there was also two or three small settlements in northern Samaria that had to be evacuated, and that should be like a sign that we have thoughts also to evacuate parts of Judea and Samaria. So all the way up there in northern Samaria, they evacuated a couple of settlements. And now, but that area still remained part of Israeli-controlled sea area. I've talked about this previously, ABC areas in Judea and Samaria. Sea is under complete Israeli control. So the law said that Jews cannot be there in this area. And it was very strange because in all sea area, a Jew can freely travel, but not there. So they just reversed that part of the decision, the disengagement decision, that now even Jews can be there. And truth is that in spite of that law that Jews cannot be there, Jews have been there. They have had a yeshiva there. And there are many things that are connected. There are also terror attacks that were connected to that place. But anyway, so that those were decisions taken this week. Now, regarding these nine settlements, they have existed for decades. Some of them were built like around 2000, some back in the 1990s, 1980s. So they have existed for a long time, but they are small and have never been approved due to internal difficulties in the governments, the coalitions, and also because of international law, the fear of international condemnation. So the settlers that live there, they have built all the infrastructure themselves. They have collected money, they have paid for it themselves, the roads, sewage, whatever there is of electricity, they have provided for it themselves. And that says something about their pioneering spirit. Anyway, they have always been vilified internationally, and they're called illegal, these settlements. So now there are claims that some of these settlements are partly built on land belonging to Palestinian Arabs. And according to Peace Now, an Israeli organization, very left-wing, very pro-Palestinian, it has a lot of facts. They interpret facts also in special ways, so cannot take it all for granted. But according to them, the settlements now that were approved, they include a total of 1,100 dunam. And of these 1,100 dunam, 420 are owned by, according to Peace Now, private Palestinians. Private Palestinian land, that's what they call it. So less than half, but 420. But this is a very common claim from Peace Now, and that's because they interpret the law in a very pro-Palestinian way. Because very often this is very weak evidence, and it's based on, well, my father said that my grandfather, very often it's like my grandfather used to have agricultural work here, and so when you have that according to Ottoman law for 10 years and so on, and there are these laws. So but some of these are just claims and cannot be substantiated, but the Peace Now, they often take this for granted. Anyway, the Supreme Court has very often followed that anti-Jewish view and ruled in favor of Palestinian Arabs. Very often it just says that Jews cannot be there, but if Arabs go there, they won't prevent that. So anyway... of course, if those settlements or parts of them are built on private land, then of course this needs to be dealt with. That shouldn't happen. And either you reach an agreement or you compensate reaching an agreement with Arab owners is almost impossible because there's a death penalty for selling land to Jews in the Palestinian Authority. But then they should in any way be dealt with in a legal way. Now, the finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, comes from the right-wing party, National Religious Party, and he said that by approving these settlements, the Israeli government is sending a clear message today to all our enemies in the face of your attempts to harm us and weaken our hold on our land. We are deepening our roots. We are building and establishing settlements. So that's his reaction. Then we have the U.S. reaction through Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, and he said, "We are deeply troubled by Israel's decision yesterday to advance reportedly nearly 10,000 settlement units and to begin a process to retroactively legalize 9 outposts in the West Bank that were previously illegal under Israeli law. Like previous administrations, Democratic and Republican, we strongly oppose such unilateral measures, which exasperate tensions and undermines the prospect for a negotiated two-state solution," and so on and so forth. And the PLO Executive Committee Secretary General, Hussein al-Sheikh, he said, "This is considered an open war on the Palestinian people and requires immediate international intervention." So there are some of the reactions. And Peace Now also says that this is rewarding illegal behavior by the settlers and it creates settler violence. It leads to that, according to Peace Now. And then they say, "Authorizing these outposts diminishes the chances for peace," according to Peace Now. And I would say, no, it doesn't diminish the chances for peace, but it diminishes the chances for a Palestinian state. And those two are not synonymous. This is also what Antony Blinken says, that it undermines the prospect for a negotiated two-state solution, that this mantra, there is no solution, that a two-state solution. And that's wrong. It's if you look at all objective measures, any way that you can look at the Palestinian Authority and see what that would become if it became a state, you would see that that's not what will lead to peace. A Palestinian state will not lead to peace. You can check the Palestinian Authority. Everything they do in regards to Israel is of a hostile character. There's no educating for peace or anything preparing for peace. So what there, on the other hand, could lead to peace, that is not a Palestinian state, but it's Israeli control of Judea and Samaria, including individual rights for Arabs that live there, all the individual rights, but not national rights. That would be the best alternative for peace. But Israel needs to control this area. And again, this is the land of the Bible. I mean, it's good to remind ourselves about this sometimes, because sometimes we forget what we're talking about because we hear so much from the international community, from the media, about the West Bank. Well, some basic facts. This is the land that historically for thousands of years were called Judea and Samaria until our days, Judea and Samaria. It is where most events of the Bible took place. And let me just mention a few names that from the Bible that are located in this area. It's not for sure that you remember all these names, but they are all in the Bible and they are all located in Judea and Samaria. Dothan, Shechem, Samaria, Elon Moreh, Mount Gerizim, Mount Ebal, Shiloh, the mountains of Ephraim, the wilderness of Judah, Jericho, Gilgal, Gibeon, Gibeah, Geva, Michmas, Bethel, Ramah, Jerusalem, Nob, Anata, Enrogel, Bethlehem, Maon, Hebron, Mamre. And these are just a few. I mean, that I took from the top of my head whilst I was preparing this. There are so many places. Some said that 70% of all the place names in the Bible are located there. I don't know if it's 70%, but I guess it would be. That's not a surprise if so. And it's therefore very, very annoying to hear Israelis, Israeli media, and also Israeli academics from think tanks that are supposed to be more or less like objective and neutral, using the word shtachim, which is Hebrew, meaning territories. Sometimes they use this word West Bank, in Hebrew, Hagadah HaMa'aravit, but very often they use the word shtachim, just the territories. And that's also so, it's supposed to be neutral to use that word. Because when you use West Bank, that is the term put on the area by Jordanians. And when you use Judean Samaria, it's put on there by the Jews. And when you use shtachim, territories, that's nothing. But it's annoying because it's so not historical. Would it hurt to use the names that have been used for hundreds and thousands of years? Are you afraid that it will create a Jewish connection to this place? Because you cannot deny the Jewish connection even by changing the name. So sometimes we need to just remind ourselves about these simple facts that Judea and Samaria, that's the name of this area. So in addition to building and approving settlements, then this government also, or at least the defense minister, decided that olive grove, including more than 1,000 olive trees and brush, forgot what they called it, these tall trees, look like a spear, more than 1,000 of these trees, most olive trees, these brush were only like circular, putting like a frame around this olive grove. They were destroyed, they were uprooted because the Supreme Court had decided that this must be done because the land is contested. It's not, some would say that this is Palestinian private land, perhaps Palestinian Arab, but it's not. It's contested. And so because of that, and because a Jew who claimed ownership and still claims ownership to the land, he had planted these trees, but now it was uprooted by this defense minister that decided, okay, now is the time to uphold the decision of the Supreme Court. And of course, now you have a government that is right-wing, only right-wing, and in it you have ultra-right-wing parties. And these, of course, were furious that the defense minister coming from the Likud party decided to do that. So one of them went up there, a woman, a female member of Knesset, Limor Son Hamelech, Harmelech. She went up there and protested against this. And she was almost attacked by these border guards, but others were really attacked, and there are terrible pictures coming out where they are kicked in their head, the Jewish demonstrators that try to prevent the guards, the military, from destroying this olive grove. And you can understand their frustration. I mean, the law, it must be upheld. When there is a decision, it has to be upheld. But there would be other ways to do this. There could be a government decision to postpone this and to take this again to the Supreme Court, because the land is not decided, the ownership is not decided. There would be another way than to uproot trees. And also because in January, for instance, I could take many examples, but in January, another Jewish-owned olive grove was uprooted, because it was illegal, according to the courts. And just 300 meters away is a huge mosque built illegally. And that's just a tiny example. Around this olive grove that was uprooted now, you can stand where this olive grove is and look on the mountains around, and you see dozens of Arab-owned or Arab-run olive groves that are also illegal. They are built on illegal on land not belonging to them. But those olive groves are not removed. And that's the problem. When the law is applied selectively, then that's not called justice. And that's why you see the frustration among these Jews, because they see that the land around them, around their settlements, are being taken over illegally by Arabs. Nothing is done. And when they try to build on a land that they own, according to them, they are met with this kind of force. So again, the law must be honored, but it must be honored equally for everyone. Just a short note, also a new book on Menachem Begin, former Prime Minister of Israel, has come out, and it's a collection of almost everything he said or wrote, like in speeches and what he wrote. So from before he went entered, from before the birth of the state and so on. From when he was even the leader of the Irgun, the Jewish underground movement and so on, but until 1980s when he stepped out of politics. So it's very interesting that it comes out right now, because Begin is seen as a liberal, right-wing, but liberal, so especially when it comes to the role of the courts. So he's famous for saying that there are judges in Israel, meaning let them have the final word, at least in that sense. Although he also claimed and stood for the view that the parliament is the highest authority. So it would be interesting to have heard what he had to say about what is going on in Israel today. Now the authors that collected this book, they say that they cannot get a clear-cut answer what his position would be today based on those writings. So, but anyway, interesting material there. And that takes us to Mishpatim, the Parashat HaShavua, the weekly Torah portion, which is from Exodus 21:1 to 24:18. A summary here is going to be long, because there's so many laws in here. According to the rabbis, there are 53 laws of the total of 613 that the rabbis say are in the Torah, in the first five books of the Bible. A total of 613, and in these four chapters, you have 53 of them. So the summary goes like this: God gives laws concerning treatment of servants, concerning punishment for violence and murder. Then we have the saying, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and so on. There are laws concerning oxen that gores people or other animals, laws concerning how to deal with thieves and what they stole, concerning destruction of theft or agricultural and other property, laws concerning virgins and sorcerers and idolaters, a command to treat strangers well, not to afflict orphans or widows, their law against taking interest and against cursing God and a ruler, laws about giving first fruits and about being holy, about not perverting the judgment for the poor or the rich, taking bribes, and a number of other laws. Then God repeats the law concerning Shabbat, and he also gives the law concerning the sabbatical year, that the land should rest every seventh year. Then he gives commands regarding the three annual feasts, including, the three annual feasts, and also not to boil a young goat in its mother's milk. An important verse for everything that has to do with kosher rules. God says he will send his angel before his people, and he says, my name is in him. There's a very interesting passage here about this angel. Then he warns the Israelites not to bow down to the idols of the local peoples. Then he will keep sickness away from them, and there will be no miscarriage or barren women among them. God also delivers the enemies into the hands, and God will deliver the enemies into the hands of the Israelites. There's a description of the borders of the land. And after all of this, the people answers, all which the Lord has said, we will do. Then they sacrifice, and Moses sprinkles them with the blood of the covenant. In the end, Moses and the elders eat and drink with God on mountain. And then Moses go further up in a mountain that is embellished in fire. That's the summary. So we have this famous saying here, an eye for an eye. And just a short note on that, because in Jewish tradition, this has not been understood literally. You shouldn't take an eye if your eye is taken, but you should compensate it with monies. And as a monetary compensation, this is what they have come to. And it has to do with the word ayin tachat ayin. Eye for an eye. Tachat means really under or instead of. And an eye instead of an eye. So they, based on this word, you can understand this, that it's not supposed to be taken literally. But, and also, of course, it doesn't really help a victim if somebody else loses their eye. So anyway, that's just to understand how it has been understood in Jewish tradition. Now, then there's also some comments on do not favor the poor in judgments, because that's what it says in verse 3 there, I think it was, I don't have it before me now, but it says do not favor the poor, because when you come before the courts and you see a rich and a poor, you shouldn't favor the poor. You shouldn't favor the rich either, but you shouldn't favor the poor is what it says. And that is a danger, because men, you and I, we have prejudice, and we can easily also be moved by superficial things, the things that are irrelevant for the matter under discussion. We tend to side with the underdog. That seems to be a pretty common feature. And we could, in that context, when siding with the underdog, disregard truth and justice, because we feel empathy and sympathy with the underdog. This is something that happens very often in the case, conflict with Israel and the Palestinian Arabs, that Israel is considered to be not the underdog, it's considered to be Goliath, and so people sympathize with the Palestinian Arabs just because they are the underdog, disregarding justice, disregarding truth. And therefore it's very interesting that it says you shouldn't favor the poor. I mean, we would normally think that it should stand rich. It should be, do not favor the rich. But this is what the Bible says. Some of us also, even we think that it's good and merciful, even Christian behavior, to favor the underdog always. And it's not. Also, we have a challenge because some movies, they also present an immoral person as the underdog and want you to side with him. So you have that influence even from Hollywood and so on. But God is truth. He's not like, you cannot bend him one way or the other. It's straight. This is the truth. Then you shall have mercy on those that suffer. You shall have mercy on people that really suffer. That is, especially when it's not their fault. But so having mercy and caring for the underdog, that's normal. But you don't change what is right. Do not pervert justice. Be objective. So this is such an important truth today for all of us. So it's good to pay attention to that. Then we have this also. What is it that makes us moral beings? That's another question coming up here. And according to, this is a commentator that I read, and he said, according to Plato, what makes us moral is knowledge, because all vices are the result of ignorance. So knowledge will take us out of it, will make us moral. David Hume, he said it is emotion that makes us moral, because we feel sympathy with people. And so when you feel sympathy, you become moral. Immanuel Kant said it's rationality, meaning we do not act immorally because we do not want others to act immorally towards us. So we don't lie to others because we don't want them to lie to us. So there are different answers to what it is that makes us moral. And then we have Rabbi Sacks, who said following that, he says, it's our treatment of strangers that really shows if we are moral. And then he said that there are two verses in this parasha. that really stand out, and it's Exodus 22:2. You must not mistreat or oppress the stranger in any way. Remember, you yourselves were once stranger in the land of Egypt. And it's Exodus 23:9. You must not oppress strangers. You know what it feels like to be a stranger, for you yourself were once strangers in the land of Egypt. So he said, this is the thing, because as men, we have a tendency to identify with a group. We are tribal, as he says. And when we do, I mean, there's something very positive with that. When we identify with a group, it gives you identity, it can give you a meaning, but that means that it becomes us and it becomes them. You are creating groups. And very often, them, that becomes the stranger, and they, you are very willing to give give of yourself to us, to those that are within, to those that are close to you that you identify with, but those that are seen as strangers, you are less willing to help and to give to them, to be altruistic to them. So, therefore, the Bible is so clear, and it, according to the rabbis, 36 times the Bible mentions this, that you should take care of the stranger, because that then you step outside this us. When you see a stranger, you know that he also is a human being. And like it says in these verses, you yourselves were once strangers. And in the other verse, you know what it feels to be a stranger. So that's the reason. And so Rabbi Sacks says, Israel had to be slaves in Egypt, had to be strangers in a foreign land in order to be able to later on become a people that would have mercy towards others and identify with others. So this is really a lesson for us all today, that we should make sure that we, even if we have, and we do have a group that is, this is us, this is who we are, that we are open, that we have a heart for the stranger. And it's very strong, this that if it's as the rabbis say, 36 times God says take care of the stranger. And especially in our days, there are so many things happening around the world, and there are strangers coming to our shores, and it's important that we dare to open up and dare to see that they need our compassion, and try to also identify ourselves. Not everybody has been stranger in a foreign land, but and for them it can be harder to identify with others. But once you have been outside and seen, it really helps also to see strangers that are among you and to value strangers and contribution. I had a bad experience here the other day when I talked to a man who said, oh, I'm so happy that there are finally some Norwegians here. There are so many immigrants. And I was talking in the specific setting that I was. And I just said, well, immigrants are very great for us. They really put some color to this boring society of ours. Try to be open towards strangers. I mean, it's really good. So the Torah, God is very keen on this, and it's interesting also to put this in the context of Israel always being the first nation to help when catastrophes hit, always being the first, but among the first to help when catastrophes hit, like the earthquake in Syria and Turkey, and even helping in Syria, which is a country that is bent on Israel's destruction, but you have this in the Jewish tradition, so that's very great. Okay, that's all for this time. As usual, if you help us spreading the podcast, we are very grateful for that, if you speak to others about it. And as I said last time, we will change the format within short, and Aletta will come in, and it will be different, more dynamic. But for now, this is still the format. And so if you want to spread the podcast, you feel free to do that. And also, if you want to support the work, we are very grateful. Our website, you can do that on our website or through Vips. Our website is israelnext.com. You can press give there, and all the fill in all the details the way you want to do it. And VIPS is a Norwegian system that you can also use. So that's it for today. I'll just finish with a priestly blessing. Yevarechecha Adonai veYishmerecha. Ya'er Adonai panav elecha veYechonecha. Yisa Adonai panav elecha veYasem lecha shalom. Amen. So until next time, say something good about Israel.